Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 14, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about Federal Reserve Accountability and the Choice Act. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Alex Pollack, Senior Fellow at the R Institute, and Norbert Michel, Senior Research Fellow of Financial Regulations and Monetary Policy at the Heritage Foundation. I'll turn it over to Norbert to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Norbert. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much. So I'm just going to start off with a rundown of choice, why it's important, what it does, and talk a little bit about broader financial regulation reforms and Fed reforms. The narrative coming out of the 2008 financial crisis was that deregulation caused the crash, and that unregulated financial markets were somehow the problem. And this is completely false. Number one, we haven't had unregulated financial markets in the U.S. really during the last century, if at all. Secondly, even the so-called deregulation that happened in the late 1990s, basically the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, it allowed for expansion of regulated activities in the banking sector. It didn't deregulate anything, and that's a big difference. And then last, all of this risky activity that you hear about regarding the 2008 crisis, mortgage lending, mortgage-backed securities, the derivatives that finance those things, all of that took place with the blessing, the explicit blessing in many cases, of federal regulators, including the Federal Reserve. So the federal rules actually made things much worse. And it's not the case that we had deregulation. It's the case that we had overregulation, and that's what led to the problem. And that really should be the starting point for any serious reform discussion. And in Congress, the only serious reform effort that takes that approach so far is what you see embodied in Chairman Jeb Hensarling's Choice Act. And the Choice Act makes many solid improvements, really good improvements to our regulatory framework, and it also includes several positive Federal Reserve reforms. So to start, it undoes some of the worst parts of Dodd-Frank. And Dodd-Frank, of course, was the bill that was passed under the Democratic Congress in response, if you will, to the 2008 crisis. Dodd-Frank did not improve our regulatory environment at all. It expanded the authority of the very same regulators who were in charge of everything that led to the crisis. And it just gave us more top-down rules of the type that created the problem to begin with. So if you want to reform the system, you have to undo the damage that Dodd-Frank did. And choice starts that process. Here are a few of the ways that it does that. Title I of Dodd-Frank is what created the Financial Stability Oversight Council, the FSOC. And that's just a regulatory body of different regulators, made up of different regulators, federal regulators, and it's tasked with identifying risks to the financial stability of the United States, which is not defined anywhere. And the FSOC identifies the firms that you'll commonly hear referred to as SIFIs, or systemically important financial institutions. These are the firms that regular people would call the too big to fail firms. Well, clearly, if you want to end too big to fail, you don't want government regulators identifying the firms that are too big to fail. And the Choice Act comes in and gets rid of that problem. It repeals that whole process, so it fixes that. Title VIII of Dodd-Frank is very similar to that, very similar to Title I. But it does that it implements that process for specialized financial firms called financial market utilities. Those are clearinghouses. Choice gets rid of that too. Choice repeals Title VIII of Dodd-Frank. Also, Title II of Dodd-Frank is something called Orderly Liquidation Authority, and that's a process where the federal government comes in and shuts down the financial firm, and it does it in a way that taxpayers are responsible for losses of the failing firm instead of simply letting the failing financial firm go through bankruptcy. Choice fixes that problem too. It gets rid of orderly liquidation and it replaces it with a normal bankruptcy proceeding. Title 10 of Dodd-Frank is the one that created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. And many people have called the CFPB something like the most unaccountable independent agency in history. A federal appeals court has actually ruled that the structure of the CFPB is unconstitutional. Choice Act fixes this problem. It doesn't get rid of the CFPB, but it does drastically change it. It changes the structure so that the director can be fired for any reason, just like anybody should be. It puts the CFPB on budget instead of this weird off-budget funding procedure that it currently has. And it takes away their rulemaking authority. So it makes the CFPB an enforcement-only agency. It says, look, you already have all these federal statutes that govern consumer protection. The CFPB's job is going to be to enforce those laws. And it takes away the abusive authority. That's another one of the ill-defined broad powers that was given to the CFPB. So the Choice Act gets rid of that as well. So it fixes essentially the entire CFPB problem, radically changes it. Title 6 of Dodd-Frank is something, one of the things that it did, rather, was implement something called the Volcker Rule. And the Volcker Rule is pitched as making this safer because it stops banks from doing proprietary trading. Well, in fact, it doesn't stop banks from doing proprietary trading. It allows them to do some proprietary trading. And it turns out that the law prior to Dodd-Frank did exactly the same thing. It allowed banks to do some proprietary trading. So without getting into the particulars of Volcker, I would say something like it's been an enormously wasted effort for very little benefit. The Choice Act fixes this as well. It repeals the Volcker Rule. Those are the five main Dodd-Frank impacts that it has. On top of that, Choice does many small business capital, entrepreneurial capital formation reforms, and the list is way too long for me to just go over in a short phone call, but it does do a lot of those things. And then the last part of this I'll talk about is what Choice does to reform the Federal Reserve. One of the things that it does is it implements something called the FORM Act. That's an acronym, but it's a broader bill, and that makes several specific improvements to the way the Fed is run. One of the things that it does is it forces monetary policy to be benchmarked. Many people will say that, and have said, that we shouldn't implement something like this because it forces the Federal Reserve to conduct monetary policy by a strict rule. And that's not actually what it does. What it does is it says that the Fed can still choose to make monetary policy however they like. However, they have to benchmark it against a Taylor rule or something like a Taylor rule and explain why they're doing something differently in the context of that rule. So the idea is to make the Fed more accountable for their monetary policy and more transparent in what they're doing with their monetary policy, rather than saying, you guys go do whatever you want. I think that's a good idea. Some other things that are some other improvements that the bill makes. It requires full transcripts of the Federal Open Market Committee meeting to be available to the public. It also removes the New York Fed president from his permanent position on the Federal Open Market Committee, and it adjusts the makeup of the committee so that one designee from each of the 12 district banks rotates every other year to vote. So it shifts the balance, it democratizes the balance a little bit more. It doesn't give one district bank an advantage over any other. It also forces the Fed chair to testify before Congress quarterly instead of semi-annually, and it also requires the vice chair of supervision to report to Congress. It also puts Federal Reserve employees under the regular government pay schedule, same as the Securities and Exchange Commission. It includes monetary policy decisions under the umbrella of what can be included in a GAO audit, a General Accounting Office audit. That's the audit the Fed portion. Right now, the Fed can be audited, but the monetary policy decisions themselves cannot go into the GAO audit. The Choice Act would change that. It also makes several reforms to the Fed's Emergency Lending Authority. It requires an above-market interest rate, and it requires a specification on the types of collateral that can be used for those emergency loans. So while I would like to see a completely different facility, I still think these are good reforms. These are reforms that are moving in the right direction on the emergency lending. So that's a positive thing. And then the last thing I'll mention is that it would enact or create a formal centennial monetary commission. And this would be a bipartisan commission that Congress would set up that would be charged with doing a top-down review of the Federal Reserve monetary policy, how it's performed in the past, and what it should be doing going forward. I think it would be an invaluable way of shedding light on what it is that the Federal Reserve does, and most importantly, what it is that the Federal Reserve should do. And that's my four or five minute rundown of the Choice Act and how it implements reforms at the Fed.
Great. I think that makes it my turn, Nover.
Yes.
This is Alex Pollack. And just to add something to Norbert's all sensible and summary remarks, the Choice Act has a lot in it, in addition to the financial institution reforms, that is relative to the administrative state and to making the administrative state accountable to the Congress, the first branch. And that's this huge philosophical issue dear to the hearts of members of the Federalist Society. Notably, it does this for the Federal Reserve in the Title 10 that Norbert discussed form, which is, I guess, the Federal Reserve Oversight Reform and Modernization Act. This Title 10 on the Fed, is in my judgment hugely important, but it's gotten virtually no media discussion. I noticed one article in the Wall Street Journal had a table of what it called the key provisions of the Financial Choice Act, and the whole title on the Federal Reserve wasn't even mentioned. It didn't make the list of key provisions, and I think it certainly is among, in my judgment, the most important of anything going on in this act. We all know the Constitution clearly gives Congress the power over money, and the money question is a huge and always political issue, how we want money to function in the society. And therefore, what is the relationship of the Fed to the Congress? There's a separate question, which I won't talk about, which is the Fed to the executive and the Treasury, and whether the central bank should be the slave of the Treasury or not. But this is the Fed and the Congress. What is the accountability of the Fed? Because it seems to me that accountability is perhaps the central concept in every part of the governance of the government, so to say. So for the Federal Reserve, this very special kind of agency, what is its accountability? Who is its boss? Who should be its boss? And the answer to this is the Congress. The Fed, like other agencies of government, is populated by unelected employees and officers and must be accountable to the elected representatives of the people. And the Fed is very much aware, of course, that the Congress, which created them, can, if they can decide, if they would ever decide to, but in theory can dissolve them, but in the meantime has to govern them. And it seems clear that the Fed should be part of a system of checks and balances. But many people disagree with this, especially economists. And they make the remarkable argument that the Fed, this agency of the Congress, should be, as they say, independent. And this independence is strongly asserted as if you can somehow have this piece of the government responsible for something so essential and so political as money, just doing what it wants. In other words, they promote the idea that the Federal Reserve governors and presidents should be a kind of philosopher kings in the Platonic style, an idea which, in my judgment, is a very poor one. And this is particularly important, I think, because of the huge risk that the Federal Reserve represents. So I'm sure we can all adopt and believe in the good intentions of the Federal Reserve, but if you think about it, it is the most financially dangerous institution in the world because it's the printer of the world's fiat currency, namely the U.S. dollar. It's the world's currency, and the decisions of monetary policy, as they say, or monetary experimentation by the Fed represent a tremendous systemic risk. And what are these decisions based on? Well, they're based on very debatable theories and guesses and very inaccurate models of a committee of economists. Basically, the Federal Reserve is run by a committee of economists, and over time, it's an institution which has created runaway inflation. It is now creating negative real returns on the people's savings. It can reduce real wages. It can stoke financial bubbles, as it did earlier in the century and may very well be doing again. It can clearly distort markets and resource allocation. And while pursuing financial stability, it can create, in fact, instability. So somebody with that potential for mischief, let's ask again, how are they to be accountable? And who is their boss? And Choice very rightly addresses this. Now, it's easy to know why the Fed consistently disappoints the expectations of those who wish it to be philosopher kings, because it's a government price-fixing committee. And like all such price-fixing efforts, it's doomed to fail because the Fed doesn't have any special knowledge of the financial future. In fact, it's subject to huge uncertainty. Things subject to huge uncertainty tend to be political. Put up against that the theory that the Fed, a government agency, should be independent, that it should not have a boss, and you have a problem. And Choice, if enacted, will fix that problem. So let's ask, how should the Fed be accountable, as every part of a democratic government should be accountable? So devoting Title 10 to these Federal Reserve provisions, which would, as Norbert said, call for more frequent consultations with the Congress on whatever the Fed is doing or thinks it's doing on monetary issues and central bank credit. But more important than the frequency, although the frequency is important, is the nature of the discussion. What we're trying to get to, what the Congress, if it enacts Choice, will be getting to, is a grown-up, real, substantive discussion of Fed, What are you trying to do? What's the evidence? What are the models? What's the uncertainty? How are you going to know if you're wrong? How are you going to know if you're right? Where have you been wrong? What can we do about the things that were wrong? And as I think about this in history, it's now a little more than 100 years since the Federal Reserve Act. On the 50th anniversary of the Federal Reserve Act, the what was then the Committee on Banking and Currency, now the Financial Services Committee, reviewed the history of the Fed. This was, of course, a Congress and a committee controlled by the Democratic Party in those days, and they had some interesting conclusions. They included this one: an independent central bank is essentially undemocratic. That's true. Of course, those who want to be philosopher kings don't want the Fed to be democratic. To the extent that the Federal Reserve operates autonomously, it runs counter to our constitutional order. And finally, Americans have been against ideas and institutions which smack of government by philosopher kings. That's true of Americans, although not necessarily true of economists who all want to be philosopher kings. And in those hearings, the then president of the New York Fed testified, obviously the Congress which set us up has the authority and should review our actions anytime they want to and in any way they want to. I think he was absolutely right about that, and now 50 years later, we're coming around to really try to set the stage for such, as I say, grown-up policy discussions. What would you do? What are you trying to do? What's the uncertainty, which will always be present? What mistakes? What's the evidence? Do we need to change course? As I said before, there is one thing that I am suggesting that should be an additional requirement for these reviews, and that's that the Federal Reserve should be required to produce what we're calling a savers impact statement, discussing what the effects of its monetary policy are on savings and savers. We know that savers have been absolutely robbed by the interest rates set by the Fed over the last 8 years, and maybe you could have justified it for a year or two, but not for 8 years. The CHOICE Act requires, in general, of regulatory rules that they provide, quote, an assessment for how the burden imposed will be distributed among market participants. And I think that is a really good element that should be part of the grown-up discussions a future Congress will have with the Fed. How are the burdens from your actions? Who is benefiting? Who is being punished? And how is that distributed throughout the society? Well, it's been 40 years. I talked about the 50th anniversary of the Fed, which is in the 1960s. It's been 40 years in the 1970s since Congress last seriously took up oversight of the Fed. So it's high time. That, in those days, gave rise to the Federal Reserve Reform Act of 1977 and the Humphrey-Hawkins Act of 1978, which tried to achieve this accountability. And I think anybody who observes the Fed's Humphrey-Hawkins appearances with the Congress know that they fail to achieve accountability, turn into media events, and that's an unsuccessful outcome. I want to close with some thoughts from a highly financially sophisticated country, Switzerland. Jean-Pierre Dantin, who was at the time the vice chairman of the Swiss National Bank, which is the central bank of Switzerland, gave an excellent speech in which he discussed independence versus accountability. And he argued that the Swiss bank should be independent, but he added, independence goes hand in hand with accountability. Independence goes hand in hand with accountability, and it's the accountability, in my judgment, that we're lacking, and that the Choice Act in its Title 10 would create. Dantine talks about the annual accountability report to the Parliament, regular meetings with both the executive and the relevant committees of the legislature, which is what we're talking about in Choice, and the creation of transparency as a goal to accountability. And it is a fact, he asserted, that Switzerland has a well-developed system of checks and balances for its central bank, and that is exactly what Choice is moving toward for the Federal Reserve and what we should want to happen. Thank you. That's my opening comments.
That's great, Alex.
Is there anything you both would like to add before we go to audience questions?
I'll add on to what Alex had there. The independence debate has always struck me as sort of strange because there's an enormous amount of history that shows that there haven't been independent. and if you just think about it, you have the Federal Reserve charged with, even since the 70s, formally charged with dealing with inflation and unemployment. In what universe would that not be a political problem? And I mean, there's just no way around that. You know, I mean, if that's what you're going to do, you've lost the independence. And the Fed pushes back. It's a bureaucracy. I understand that. In terms of not wanting to have this sort of this auditing stuff and this accountability, but you know, the truth of the matter is that having this sort of framework allows them to push back against people who want them to do other things and say, no, we have a more defined, a very narrow framework that we can operate in. This is what Congress gave us. I'm sorry, Senator, or I'm sorry, Congressman. This is what you guys have told us to do, and that's what we're doing. As opposed to now, which, you know, they can just kind of say whatever they need to say to justify what they're trying to do.
Norbert, I think that's a terrific point that in addition to the money question, mm-hmm. the questions of employment, inflation, mm-hmm. purchasing power, all these are mm-hmm. fundamentally and always a necessary political.
Mm-hmm.
To pretend mm-hmm. that they somehow become a question of technocracy.
Right.
Like how much cement do you have to put in a bridge if you don't want it to fall down?
Right.
The Fed's questions are nothing like that.
That's right.
They're fundamentally political, and which is the political branch. It's the elected representatives of the people
mm-hmm.
who should be exercising control. Now, what economists, when you discuss this, always say is, well, you can't have mere politicians debating these questions of monetary policy, but I don't think the economists have covered themselves with glory over many years right up to now in doing this. So to me, that question, which is so seriously debated, of independence versus accountability, needs to be forthrightly addressed and the accountability created.
We agree completely on this one.
That's good.
Yeah.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Let's go to our first question.
This is Bert Ely calling. Very interesting conversation. You know, I'm just not, you know, that knowledgeable about financial and economic matters. And so kind of a basic question has come to mind. Why is it necessary for the Federal Reserve to have any influence over interest rates? I mean, we let the markets determine the price of breakfast cereals and the like. Why is it necessary for a government agency like the Federal Reserve to influence interest rates?
Hi, Bert.
Hi, Norbert.
I can take a crack at that one. I mean, okay. I mean, so in principle, you shouldn't. I mean, we shouldn't have this framework. A lot of people talk about the dual mandate of inflation and unemployment, and it's actually got three components. The last one is moderate interest rates. And the truth of the matter is they have very limited influence. It's not as though you can just make interest rates whatever you want, even if you are the Federal Reserve. And it's not something that we should have, if you believe in free market principles, then it's not something that you should have a government entity trying to manipulate.
Bert, I know you're a great admirer of the Federal Reserve and wish always to increase their power. There is another very relevant point on your most pertinent question, and that is, even if you could set the interest rate, and nobody, including the Fed, knows what the interest rate should be.
That's right.
They can't possibly know that. It's a price. The way you set prices is by having markets, and so they're in taking onto themselves, which was not in the original Federal Reserve Act or the original conception of the Fed, had no idea that they were somehow going to control the economy by controlling interest rates. But it's an assignment that no one can possibly do successfully.
And I fully agree, and pardon my somewhat facetious nature of my question, but you know, the thing that I find interesting is, and maybe y'all have some insights on this, and that is how rarely does anybody, particularly in the economics sphere, challenge the rate setting powers of the Fed. It's even, I've heard this even out of a conservative and libertarian economist, that the only way that interest rates can be determined is and properly influenced is through the intervention of a monetary authority like the Fed. The idea that markets should set interest rates without Federal Reserve influence seems heretical, even to a lot of free market economists.
When I have asked why this is, one answer I've been given is, who do you think is the world's largest employer of PhD economists?
Yep.
Well, it's just a question that needs to be posed much more often.
And as a graduate of a traditional PhD economics program who studied specifically monetary economics, I can tell you one of the strangest things that I ever encountered, because I didn't know this before school, is that when you earn your PhD in economics and you specialize in monetary economics, you don't really encounter these questions very much, if at all. And if you do, it's because you're doing this on your own. It's not part of the standard curriculum to even question this.
Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, Bert, you've had enough time.
good afternoon. This is Ned Jacobs. Are Rand Paul and Ron Paul in favor of this Choice Act that's being discussed? And then is there any possibility or is it advisable that the United States should consider going off of a fiat monetary system and back into some sort of gold, silver system?
You may know on the political question, Norbert. I don't know.
So I don't. I honestly do not know if they support the Choice Act. I know that they would support the audit portion, the audit the Fed portion. That's a standard audit the Fed type bill there. But I'm racking my brain, and I can't think of whether they've out in public whether they've supported Choice or not. I couldn't say. As far as the going off the fiat standard, my personal belief on that, after what I like to think is I'd like to give what I think is an informed opinion on that one. I don't think it is what so many people now think it is. In other words, I think everybody looks at it as a favorable time and a favorable policy and a better way of doing things. And, you know, the truth is that that system broke down for political reasons, just like any monetary system could break down for monetary reasons. And to go on to a redeemable metal system now would require the cooperation of many international parties, and they would have to cooperate by agreeing to not screw things up. And the chances of that happening and working for a very long period of time are just really small. And unfortunately, as great as part of the gold standard period was, that period also proves that you cannot get governments to cooperate and agree not to do anything for very long. So I don't think we should go back to that standard. I don't think we should force that standard on people.
I think Norwood is right that there is no ideal monetary system. They all have their problems.
Yeah.
In August 1971, the United States reneged on its Bretton Woods commitment to redeem dollars for gold, but it really wasn't a choice. They were broke. They couldn't continue redeeming for gold because the gold was disappearing. So I think that the direction of the Choice Act, which is to continue this strange, I think it's fair to call it strange, fiat currency system, but to make it a truly accountable fiat currency system may be the best thing that you can do among a series of choices, none of which are the ideal, because the ideal doesn't exist.
Right, and I would throw in, just to sort of broaden my answer a little bit there, if this sort of thing were to happen organically, I think that would be great. And I'll go even further and say that I think we should have policies in place that allow people to choose whatever they want. That doesn't mean that everybody's going to just dump the U.S. dollar. The chances of that happening are probably pretty small. But having viable alternatives can only help give people a choice in currency and let the best currency win is I think, the right way of looking at it. Now, how you implement that, that's an open question. That's a lot of debate. But that's if you believe, again, in free market principles, they shouldn't stop when it comes to money.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for our next question, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, June 15th. That call will be on legislating clemency and model penal code reforms, featuring John Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation and Margaret Love of the Law Office of Margaret Love. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls, and to consult the full schedule of upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Hester Peirce, and I came in a little late, so I'm not sure whether you addressed this, but can you talk a little bit about macroprudential policy and what that means for how the Fed regulates and conducts monetary policy?
Hi, Hester. We did not cover that. Alex, do you want me to go, or do you want to?
Go ahead.
Okay. So choice does not, in my estimation, go far enough on this one. I'm on record in a couple of different places as saying that the Fed should not be in the business of regulating at all. They should be doing monetary policy, not bank regulation. That said, whoever's doing it, I'm not really a fan of the macroprudential regulatory approach either. So choice does not really address that. Choice does provide the opportunity for some banks to elect into a system that relieves them of a lot of the macroprudential stuff, but it doesn't end it. That would be my quick answer on that one.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
I want to ask a question without entering star. Can I, Norbert?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the makeup of the Open Market Committee, which I think is very interesting, actually,
mm-hmm.
because it dethrones, as you pointed out, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
That's right.
Which has always had the big special role, and, of course, right up through the most recent crisis, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was on,
yep.
close on the team. You are supporting that idea, I think, not to give New York a special role, even though they've always had one, at least so far.
Correct. I'm supporting that, and I would go even further. I would say let every district bank president get on the committee. If they want to rotate every other year, that's fine. I would even say tilt the balance back so that it's either even between the board and the district banks, or, well, you couldn't have even, but either a smaller majority, or have the Fed district bank presidents have the majority, especially if you do something like take away the regulatory authority at the Fed. Internally, that sort of shifts the balance from the district banks to the board even more. So a way of countering that would be to give the district banks more seats on the Federal Open Market Committee than the board has. And I think that would be a win.
I think I also am in favor of the idea of more geographically diversified
mm-hmm.
opinions. We know the committee is dominated by the chairman and the staff.
Right.
And the board.
Right.
And the way I interpret these provisions is trying to let the rest of the country
mm-hmm.
outside of the Washington,
that's right.
New York axis have more to say.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. I think that's definitely the way to go. And there will be a new FORM Act, by the way, that's coming. So there'll be some opportunities to influence policy that way. Those could be some changes that Congressman Barr is open to.
I'll make another call for questions from the audience. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing one, I'll ask one of my own. What do you think are the chances are of this getting through the Senate?
Oh, great question.
That one's to you, Norm.
The chance of a bill very similar to the Choice Act getting through the Senate in regular order is really small. In other words, you don't have the 60. You can't get the 60 vote threshold. The Republicans don't have the numbers. However, the interesting thing, the very interesting thing, is that a lot of what's in Choice could be done in a reconciliation bill. And you don't need to worry about the 60-vote threshold to do that. You only need to get to the 51 votes, and the Republicans do have those numbers. And what's even more interesting about that is that the Congressional Budget Office did a score of the Choice Act that says if you enact the Choice Act, you will actually shrink the deficit by $24 billion. So the CBO report essentially gave the Senate a green light to do Choice Act reforms in a budget reconciliation process. And while I could not possibly predict precisely what will be in the budget reconciliation bill, I think there's actually a very good chance that you will see some of the major reforms in Choice go through that reconciliation process and come out of the Senate that way. Probably in the fall. I just can't say which provisions, but something.
We have a caller from the audience.
I'd like to ask you folks a question about the independence of the Fed, which you've put a lot of emphasis on, or the importance of the Fed's independence being limited in some ways. Whichever branch of government the Fed would be accountable to would ultimately be political, which I see you gentlemen are defending. What if the Congress or the White House or both were controlled by people who wanted a Keynesian fiscal policy? Wouldn't that be sort of a libertarian nightmare? And in that instance, wouldn't economic libertarians themselves want an independent Fed that could refuse to print money to facilitate that kind of Keynesian policy? In other words, I'm not sure what the best answer is here. I'm a big fan of separation of powers, so I'm not trying to say that I don't find your arguments persuasive or very attractive, but I do see the ultimate problem if the shoes get on the other feet.
Well, we have definitely had, if I could jump in there, situations with Congress controlled by Keynesians, and the Fed has moved to being controlled by Keynesians. That started back in the 1960s when various macroeconomists very embarrassingly, as it turned out, declared that they now had the power to, quote, fine-tune the economy, unquote, and they soon ran into huge recessions and then runaway inflation with their fine-tuning. Of course, whatever theory, and I think your comment rightly points out that we're talking here about theories, and we all have preferences, including those who run the Fed in theories, but they're theories about how monetary systems and economies work. And the theories in the heads of the people who are running the monetary policy are hugely important issues, but they all need to be debatable, in my judgment, and subject to checks and balances like everything else in the constitutional government. And they, of course, if the government falls into the hands of people you disagree with, you're going to be unhappy, but there ought to be nonetheless the protection of the debate back and forth between the branches. Now, the big danger relative to the executive branch is that the central bank merely becomes the agent for financing the Treasury's deficit. That's what we've got right now, and we've often had in history, especially during wartime. Basically, the Federal Reserve and all central banks in the world sign up to finance the deficits and print however much money it takes to monetize the government's debt. So the executive is always wanting to finance the operation with deficits. So you're right that sometimes the Congress thinks that too, but in my judgment, the superior check is the first branch, and as I say, a grown-up discussion on how we, and as I interpret the Choice Act, are not saying that the Congress is going to sit as the Open Market Committee, but there's going to be a deep and meaningful discussion about what do you think you're doing, what is your theory, what are reasons to believe in or not to believe in that theory, what things are going counter to your expectations, and therefore what we should do, and I think that's the best protection there is in a constitutional order. It won't make all of us happy all the time, for sure, exactly as you suggest.
I couldn't put it any better.
I have a follow-up question, if you all wouldn't mind me asking it. Would that be okay?
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it.
You mentioned earlier the concept of too big to fail and so on. The Fed actually has, I mean, you both know this, has a pretty complex balance sheet and fairly malleable authority to purchase things on its own account. It seems to me that the Fed, if it wanted to, can essentially bail anybody out simply by deciding to purchase that entity's securities or liabilities or so on, or just to absorb them. Am I wrong in that perception? And does this legislation address that, or do you come to the conclusion that we want that kind of flexibility in the Fed to be able to make those kinds of decisions in a little bit of a gross way to just absorb somebody's problems?
Well,
you want to start, Norbert? Or?
Okay, sure. I'll start. I mean, so they are limited. I mean, they can't. They're limited in the types of securities that they can buy. Now, and you know, maybe not enough. I don't know. I don't want them to have a great deal of flexibility. I think the concept of lender of last resort needs to be sort of debated or viewed differently. I think the flexibility that we've given them to be a lender of last resort has sort of flipped things around to the point where they become a lender of only resort or first resort and crowd out the private options. Now, there's different ways of dealing with that. Our friend George Selgin, who's over at Cato, has, I think, an innovative proposal that would work, and similar to something that the Bank of England did, and that's to take to change the open market operations so that you don't have a primary dealer system anymore. You have a standing liquidity facility that all banks can participate in, and it would be an auction facility. It would be done in a market, and you in times of emergency, ostensibly, you could still get liquidity, but you'd have to pay for it. And if it was incredibly emergent, a really bad emergency, in theory, you'd have to pay much more. So it would function in that manner, and there would not be any need for emergency lending, separate emergency lending. And separate what we would call bailouts. I don't know that there's a perfect way of doing it, but I think that's a much better way of doing it.
Actually, that's something I do know. I do know there is not a perfect way of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once you have this, you've got various issues, so to speak. So it's trying to make it, as I think, again, as democratic as possible, as accountable as possible. And to have, I think the goal should be to have as minimal a footprint as possible in all respects.
That said, Norbert, though, there are times in the middle of a financial panic when it's handy to have this.
Mm-hmm.
And how you create the balancing effects within the branches are key. Now, central
mm-hmm.
bank, I mean, there is the Fed, which is, interestingly, not called the bank, is it? It's not the Bank of the United States. It's this decentralized, at least in
mm-hmm.
theory, decentralized set of banks. But that's one particular central bank. In principle, central banks can buy anything.
Mm-hmm.
Central banks
mm-hmm.
can and have and do buy equities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true.
Or any kind of asset. Central banks buy gold. Although
yeah.
the Fed owns not 1 ounce of gold, interestingly enough, coming back to the gold standard question. And the Central Bank of the United States now owns $1.8 trillion worth of mortgages, which is an astonishing idea, precisely to help bail out, as the questioner was pointing out, two failed organizations, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to support their mortgage-backed securities
yeah.
In the market. The Fed did exactly what the question is about. It went about $1.7 trillion, which is a big number, of mortgage assets. So I think it's a really important question, and exactly how to find your way through it all isn't that easy to see.
No, that's right. And George, again, to go back to George, George has made the point, I think, very well that I'll make it myself. I'll give my own version. You could make an argument that if you have a Fed that can only buy treasuries, well, you know, that actually slants the market in one direction. It does actually provide an incentive for treasuries over other types of credit. So we have to be careful with how we think that through. And there are no easy answers. I think in another, so you can see probably the one point of any sort of disagreement that Alex and I have on this, friendly disagreement, but you know, is that in times of crisis, having a special facility. You know, Alex is probably more amenable to that than I am. I think that the system should be reconfigured so that you don't have that. I think that would actually be better. I think that if you have the the lending facility, the liquidity facility structured properly, so that under normal circumstances, everybody who needs liquidity and is willing and able to pay the right price can get it, I think then that is all you would need. That would usurp the special facility in special times, because the argument would be that in those special times, if you need more than what you can get under the regular facility by paying for it, even in heightened times of crisis, then what you actually need is to close up shop, that you're not just illiquid, you're insolvent. That would be the flip side of that argument. And I'm not saying, I don't want to put words in Alex's mouth, but I think Alex and I might disagree a little bit on how to handle that part.
We may, and we're now deeply into the fundamental theory of central banking.
Yeah.
It's actually not what this Title X of the Choice Act is about.
That's true.
Taking the central bank you've got and making it accountable, and we really agree on that.
Definitely, 100%.
Not seeing any more questions, would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
No, I'd just say thank you to Alex and thank you to the Federalist Society. This has been great.
Great to be with you all. Thank you very much for sponsoring this this chance to discuss these very important things.
Mm-hmm.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.